This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face to face with business decisions, online at www.bgov.com, and of course on the air right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. President Barack Obama announced during the State of the Union address earlier this year that talks would begin on the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership with the European Union, now scheduled for later this summer. But what does that mean for U.S. big business? And actually, not just U.S. big business, but European business, Chinese business. Here to explain is senior global business and trade analyst with Bloomberg Government, Mr. Ken Monahan, whose latest study addresses that question. Ken, thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Alan. Thanks for having me.
The study, I got to tell you, I've read it several times, and every time I read it, I get more and more, I don't know if I want to say frustrated or what. Companies are spending a lot of their own money just on their own goods.
Right. We estimate that companies are you know, hit with about $4.5 billion in additional costs on tariffs, import tariffs that are levied at the border on companies' own goods.
I built the car, and now I got to pay to bring it into the country.
And my parts, and I've got to bring in this windshield, or I've got to bring in this component of the car. Whether it's made by my company or a subsidiary, whatever it might be, and that's an additional cost right on the bottom line for a company's own product.
I guess if there's any silver lining in this, it's that we're not the only ones paying this. It's European Union. All the countries in the Union are doing the exact same thing.
Right, and that's what we look at in the studies is both, because you've got U.S. companies that are invested in Europe and bringing in goods from their U.S. operations, and you've got BMW has a huge operation in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and they're doing the same thing with U.S. jobs and U.S. company, or essentially U.S.-based operations, and then they're bringing in their goods from Europe. So it's a very kind of symbiotic relationship.
Take a Six Sigma approach at this. This is more than a Kaizen waiting to happen. This is pretty big. Somebody could come noodle this through and save. Well, that's where the president steps in.
Well, hopefully. I mean, we'll see. I mean, we'll see what happens with this. And I think one of the points about trade agreements is they take a long time to from start to finish. And I think there's a certain degree, or say a strong degree of enthusiasm for this agreement, both in the U.S. and in Europe. The president has obviously put his foot forward and said, we're going to go ahead and do this. And the European Commission in Europe is very enthusiastic about getting a deal done. But one of the things we talk about is just how hard it is to actually finish these agreements.
Right.
And we can talk more about the specifics, but getting to the end is often a lot harder than starting one of these.
The study is called U.S.-EU Investment Drives 4.6 Trillion Economic Relationship. That relationship is definitely a two-way street, as we kind of talked about here. Let's examine the notion of that intra-company trade. It's actually more than a notion. You've got a statistic here and some dollars, managed to estimate some dollars. The U.S. and European Union companies have about $4.5 billion in tariffs on their own products in 2011.
Right, and that's and to kind of untangle what intercompany trade is, essentially, if you think about it, is you've got, GM has an operation in Germany, for example, making cars, and they want to import, either the full cars or certain components of those cars from, Detroit or somewhere in the United States. They're paying tariffs on that equipment they're bringing over, and the same thing goes for BMW or Daimler with their U.S. based, or Volkswagen, all German companies that have substantial investments in the U.S. So they're paying these tariffs, and so you're able to look at using publicly available data to kind of untangle and break out some of those impacts, particularly for the industries that are most dependent on intercompany trade.
Speaking of industries, we know the auto industry obviously takes up a large chunk. What other areas are we looking at?
I mean, autos are certainly, I'd say motor vehicles are the biggest. You've also got pharmaceuticals, medical equipment, and chemicals are really the big industries that have really the largest shares, if you will, the largest percentages of intercompany trade being shipped, back and forth across the U.S. and Europe. And again, it's the fact that these industries in the U.S. and the EU are very complementary. And so it's not one of these zero-sum games where people say, well, if our trade goes up, it'll be great for us and bad for Europe. And this is not the way that companies and the economy is built anymore. It's complementary economies with goods that are invested here and there, and, right. and they're sourcing certain components there and there. And when companies are doing this increasingly, they're hit with these tariffs and these marginal, you know, hits on their margins, because quite simply they've got to comply with, you know, customs rules and the rest of it. This agreement ostensibly would eliminate a lot of that and make it easier for companies to source and save some money.
The U.S. and Korea entered into an agreement similar to this. I would imagine the framework of which will be the same or similar. They'll use it as a roadmap.
Certainly, and in both the U.S. and Europe concluded agreements with Korea around the same time. Mm-hmm. Europe's was in place actually before the U.S., but the two agreements are not identical, but
right.
with Korea, but they're quite similar. And so many have said, and I tend to agree with this notion, that the agreement will certainly, if not borrow from, you know, use many of the similar elements with the Korea deal as a framework, and then
right.
they'll work on specific issues as they are relevant to the U.S. and the EU.
Obviously not something that can be hashed out overnight. How long do you think it's going to, 2014, 2015? Are we looking down the road, and are companies now banking on this, going, please, give us some relief?
Well, this is, I think, one of the real open questions right now, and there's a pretty hefty amount of skepticism about that this can be concluded quickly.
Right.
But I'll back that up in terms of saying I think the European Commission has been pretty vocal about wanting to get a deal completed by the middle of 2014, if not, you know, towards the end of next year. I mean, even if this was an easy agreement, and this will not be an easy agreement,
right.
Just the way these things go, I can tell you this is a very ambitious time frame. And I've heard U.S. government officials over the U.S. Trade Representative saying publicly that they're not sure if 2014 is going to be so so likely an endpoint, and largely in recognition of the fact that there are a lot of, you know, complicated issues. And also the more, and we talk about this in the study, and the more you try to untangle things and the more you try to really address longstanding issues, there's agricultural issues that are very deeply embedded, and others, you can't do these things overnight. And, you know, Ambassador Kirk, former USTR, U.S. Trade Representative, said, we're going to try to, you know, complete this agreement on one tank of gas. Well, that's fine, but, you know, is that going to be something you can do quickly, or is it going to take a while? And do you want to have another, if you're going to do it in one shot, you've got to want to make sure you've really accomplished as much as you can. And long way of saying, I think that it's going to be probably beyond 2014 that you'll see the deal wrapped up.
Are people screaming for a resolution to this, or is it just, this is the way it's been, and this is just the way we have to do? We've already worked it into our budget, so let's just keep going.
I think to some degree, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, when this was first initially discussed, you know, a year and a half ago, there was a fair amount of enthusiasm simply
right.
because of the extent to which, and we talk about this in terms of the numbers in the study, but that there's trade and investment across the Atlantic. But I think companies have kind of accepted that this is the way that things are, and we operate with the restraints that we do. But absolutely, there's a lot of enthusiasm about getting a deal done. But if there's a long delay and, you know, things drag on and the issues are intractable, companies may tune out and say, okay, well, we've done our best.
Yeah.
To follow this, but we're gonna wait and see until you actually show us a result. And that's the biggest risk, is that things will take a long time and not get to an end point.
So we're looking at $2.4 billion, the number paid by U.S. companies on its own products, about $2.1 billion from the European Union, making up that $4.5 billion. That money is going to the opposite countries, obviously. Those countries have that built into whatever finances they're working with. So what would an agreement do to those countries to offset, or how would we offset that money that we're now expecting from another company who's exporting goods with an intra-company?
Yeah, I mean, I think companies or the governments certainly try to offset those tariffs or taxes through other revenue measures. It's
right.
it's never, you know, completely clear, you know, what they'll exactly do. They may raise certain fees for certain in certain ways, whatever
it
might be.
That's just great.
But right. No, so right. So you end up, so I mean, if they're going to try to balance it out and have a balanced approach to it in terms of the budget impact, I think it's never one of the major or controversial elements of these
right.
things. It's about reducing the costs and streamlining, you know, for businesses, and then somehow, one way or another, they'll work out the revenue issue if it's a problem.
Tell you what, you don't have to pay for the spare tire now.
Exactly.
Anymore in your car. Oh, guess what? There's no
right,
spare
right,
tire
sure,
in
right.
the car now.
That's so, you know, one way or another, they'll get their shit. No, I mean, but yeah. it's that's just, again, to repeat, I think those aren't, generally considered the controversial aspects of these agreements.
Right.
I think it'll be something that they'll particularly in Congress, they'll try to work out the revenue offset for this, assuming they want to create one or have one in there. But
the heads of state are going to want to keep big business happy and keep them in their country to continue getting the revenue that they get from them and the jobs as well.
Right, and also big business and also smaller companies as well that may see opportunities where we certainly identify some of the bigger companies that are leading in terms of revenue here. We've got Ford, General Motors, and Dow, mm-hmm. and DuPont, and Johnson & Johnson. It can go on and on, but on the U.S. side of the ledger. But, certainly smaller companies as well will benefit, not just from the reduction in tariffs, but also if they reduce regulatory burdens and, the costs of entering the market for a right. product or getting a drug approved by the European authorities. Certainly, maybe even smaller manufacturers may see an opportunity where they just weren't even bothering to get in because the compliance costs were so high. So I think there's a lot of opportunities here, depending on how the agreement gets, crafted in the final.
I can't help but make an Apple comparison here. Is there a way to make it apples to apples, so to speak? That was really bad. But you get the idea. Apple has got tons of money set aside overseas for research, development, and such. How would that be resolved, or would that be resolved with this partnership?
Well, I think it all depends on really what the tech industry, particularly Apple, in terms of how they, a couple of things to answer that. I mean, if they're producing a lot of their goods and their electronics in Asia or probably less so in Europe, there may not be as much of an impact on their trade flows and their what they actually make and where they make it. Although, one of the things I've always said is that you never know exactly when an agreement's actually implemented, mm-hmm. what'll happen afterwards. I don't think that the agreement will have anything specific about offshoring or bringing money back and all that. I mean, that's often in the kind of the wheelhouse of the tax, authorities in Congress and how they write those. But I think that more broadly, when you talk about some of the companies in the industries we identify in the study, and you've got the automakers, chemicals, and the drug companies, for example, you really are talking about what will change for them. How will this agreement incentivize or change their assumptions about why they might operate in Europe or in the U.S.? Will it may bring more jobs to the U.S. or will it actually see more jobs in Europe, or will it be a net benefit for both sides? And those are the kinds of things that I think we'll watch closely, and we don't know right now exactly how those things will play out. But certainly, anytime you change the rules of the road,
right.
Things will shift. So it'll be worth watching for sure.
Left open for interpretation, I would imagine, at some point as well.
Right.
At some point. Okay, so we get the partnership nailed out. 2014, 2015, maybe even 2016. Who knows? It's all ironed out. We've got everything on paper. Everybody agrees. The ink's dry. Well, are we missing anything? Is there a downside to this?
I mean, I think that one of the main points that I would make, and I think others have probably said this as well, is that the fact that the economies are so complementary and the fact that there's already such a high degree of investment and integration that it's to my earlier point, you never know exactly what will happen in terms of trade flows and investment. But these are economies that are not, they're not, you don't see, particularly in this time of world global business, that you see companies say, oh, now we're going to completely abandon the U.S. market. Quite the opposite. I think there's a lot of strong advantages for the U.S. in terms of cheaper energy prices, sure. for companies, particularly in the manufacturing space, to invest and produce more in the U.S. And so if you streamline regulations to make it even easier for being cognizant of safety and public health and the rest of it, for companies to operate here, one could imagine a scenario in which even more European companies or others, not even just European companies,
sure.
Chinese companies or others, decide
sure.
to invest in the U.S. because they've got an opportunity to then take advantage of reduce costs getting into Europe. So
sure.
there's any number of ways in which this can play out, and all of this depends on the degree of ambition and how comprehensive the negotiators are able to make this agreement.
Could this be opened up to other countries outside of the union itself? I mean, is that door closed, or we would have to work out another agreement?
Well, I mean, it's a really good question, Alan, because there are recently has been a lot of concern expressed by countries such as Turkey, which has a partnership with Europe mm-hmm. and has a strong desire to negotiate a U.S. agreement with the U.S. The Prime Minister was here a couple weeks ago and talked about this, and with President Obama. And there's also concern about from Canada and Mexico that countries with
I was going to bring up Canada and Mexico.
The NAFTA and the U.S. No, it's a particularly, I think, a really interesting point. And what you'll hear from authorities, and frankly, I'll agree with this, is that when you add any more, countries to the table, it only makes an already difficult negotiation that much harder.
Sure.
But
everybody wants to get a benefit.
Everyone wants to get a benefit. And yeah. they're saying, well, this is my thing. And so, however, if you pull leave them aside, and then you negotiate an agreement and conclude it, let's say in 2014, 2015, or whatever, mm-hmm. and then say, well, these are the rules of the agreement, take it or leave it.
Right.
You know, Canada or Mexico. And these countries are already very integrated in the U.S. market. Turkey with Europe, the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's not like they're going to be, forced to take on commitments that are completely foreign or they're not going to understand them. But one could imagine you like to be, if you're sitting in a room, you're buying your house, and you don't like to just say, oh, yeah, I'll just take it, whatever you give me. You want to be in there and say, well, I understand what that wall is going to look like, and I'm going to make sure that sure. it looks the way I think it does. Or, you're going to say, well, it's fine, I'll just take it the way, whatever you throw at me. I mean, that's the concern, I think, that certainly Canada, Mexico, and Turkey on the other side, just to pick a few really more prominent examples, are feeling right now. And I think that, to get to your question, I don't think they'll be joining the negotiations right now. There may be, as they get closer to the conclusion, maybe there's an opportunity to bring them in some kind of observer status. But at this point, that's not something that's being considered.
Observer status. I could just see them in the observation room, right. sitting on the outside going, whoa, gosh, that's a really good question.
That's a really good question. I wish I was in there and I could answer. No, I mean, I do think that in all seriousness, they will. There. I mean, I can't speak to anything. There will be some opportunity for consultations and making sure that they're aware of what's happening. But, the official line coming out of the U.S. is that this is a complicated enough negotiation. It'll be focused on Europe.
Yeah.
And where that goes in terms of broadening it is a really interesting thing. We're all following it to see what will happen.
And I, too, will be following it to see what happens. This is extremely interesting. And, I can only imagine companies' budgets decreasing. As a result, being able to hire more people to do more labor, more work, because of the fact that they don't have to worry about the tariff as much, depending on how the agreement is worked out.
It depends on how the agreement is worked out and what companies decide to do with that. I mean, whether it's hiring, or increasing R&D, research and development, or whatever else it might be increasing. There could any number of ways companies can decide to reinvest any cost reductions that they may gain from this agreement. But I think that for sure there will be an opportunity for companies to benefit from this.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, and we're talking taxes or tariffs with senior global business and trade analyst Ken Monahan. His latest study, U.S.-EU investment drives $4.6 trillion economic relationship. Ken, what's next? What do we have to look out for next?
Right. Well, I think the next step, the U.S. and the EU are both undergoing consultations with stakeholders, businesses, Congress on the U.S. side, in Europe with the European Parliament and member states. This process should wrap up around June 20th, or middle of June next month. And negotiations are expected to begin soon thereafter. So sometime, in the summer, essentially, mm-hmm. for the first, we call them rounds of negotiations. So when all the negotiators come together and lay out the issues and start to really get to the nitty-gritty of the problems. And so from that point forward, you'll have additional rounds of negotiations through this year and then into next year, kind of to what we were getting at earlier. Certainly 2014 is being mooted as a possible endpoint.
Right.
I think that there's a certain degree of realism, at least on the U.S. side, that this will probably take a bit longer than that. So we're talking at least a year, probably of real active negotiations,
right.
perhaps a bit longer. And again, that all gets back to how much they try to accomplish and how they try to address some of these deep-seated issues, particularly on regulations. I think that's one of the areas where there's a lot of kind of unresolved questions about what they will try to do and how extensive they'll try to address those issues. Long and short of it is, I think both the U.S. and the EU want to avoid an outcome or a negotiation that just keeps on going
right.
on and on and on, because that I think businesses again will just tune out and not.
Yeah, it's never going to happen. Let's just keep on going. These guys can't agree to anything.
And then they won't push their congressional leaders to push the administration on this, and then Congress doesn't care as much.
Right.
And then the administration doesn't care about, and then it starts to fall apart, and then it just goes away. And that's happened before with very ambitious trade negotiations in the past. And I think I think everyone's learned their lesson, but they're trying to make sure that they keep this thing circumscribed as they can in terms of what
right.
the issues will be, where to go with them, and how long it'll take to resolve them.
You have really tense negotiations like that. One thing that they want to make sure that they do is have like modeling clay on the desk, on the tables. You've been in meetings like that, right? Modeling clay or maybe Rubik's cubes or something to play with just to take their minds off.
I think it is, or Alan, one of those exercises where you fall back with people. You stand up on a chair and you fall back, and hopefully everybody catches you when you fall.
There you go.
Team building type of exercise.
Team.
I think it's one of those things where right now it's a lot of excitement, and then it's going to get hard for a while. And then hopefully there'll be more excitement. I mean, again, hopefully for the sake of companies and some of the benefits that can accrue from these agreements. But, you know, that there will be a return to happiness and joy once you've gotten to the end of this thing. Again, that's what both the U.S. and the EU want.
Yeah. Then on to Canada and Mexico, eh?
And then bringing on and then supersizing NAFTA. So we'll see how it all works itself out. But I think there's a lot to follow here, and we'll be watching it pretty closely here at Bloomberg Government.
His name is Ken Monahan. He's a senior global business and trade analyst with Bloomberg Government. Thanks for being here.
Happy to be here, Alan. Thanks for having me.
As we discussed earlier in the program, the president addressed this very topic during his State of the Union address on February 12th. February 13th, Bloomberg Television's Market Makers addressed the topic. Here's Sarah Eisen and Stephanie Ruhle, along with the president.
It was a long-awaited decision aimed at growth and jobs, trying to create both at the world's two biggest economies at a time where they desperately need a boost. Listen.
And I'm announcing that we will launch talks on a comprehensive transatlantic trade and investment partnership with the European Union, because trade that is fair and free across the Atlantic supports millions of good-paying American jobs.
It was an important green light from the president to pursue this deal to tackle mainly non-tariff barriers that have caused disputes between the U.S. and the EU. For instance, the U.S. has criticized EU curbs on hormone-treated beef and some other agricultural issues, biotech issues. And in fact, I was just going through Bloomberg Government, which analyzes company impact of these types of stories for us. They found that eliminating trade barriers would allow U.S. exports to avoid $6.4 billion in annual duties, so real boost to the exporters.
What about the European perspective here?
Well, certainly they are mired in recession and debt crisis. I don't have to tell you guys. They have come out very swiftly after the president putting out statements saying they're encouraged by it. They want to act immediately and that the deal should be finalized by 2 years. In fact, on Bloomberg Surveillance, Scarlett and I even got a chance to talk to the EU ambassador to the U.S. this morning for an instant reaction. Listen.
I think this is a boost for both sides of the Atlantic. And frankly, I think both our economies need a boost of trust and confidence for consumers, for investors. And what we're trying to do here, what our leaders are trying to do, and we are working on the ground here in Washington very much with our American friends, is to bring down the barriers to trade and investment.
One trade official from the EU actually came out and said that there are no explicit carve-outs in this deal, meaning maybe no specific industries are exempt from it. That's an encouraging sign. They are talking a lot about agriculture and trying to fix some of the issues there. Already, economists are going back to the drawing board and trying to figure out what kind of boost this would be, say, to German exports. And the talks with the EU may also help the president in one of the goals, which is to fight a more competitive China, or at least to balance out a more competitive China, particularly on the issue of trade.
Forget German exports. We need Greek exports, Italian exports, Spanish
exports. Maybe a little bit out of Portugal.
Well, this is for all the 27 nations of the EU, so theoretically, could be good for all of them.
Sarah Eisen, Stephanie Ruhle, and of course, President Barack Obama during the State of the Union address. And with that, we put the wraps on another edition of Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. Follow us on Twitter at BGov. Follow me at Alan L. Scott for show updates. Make sure to tune into Bloomberg Government's television program, Capital Gains, hosted by Bloomberg Television's Peter Cook, Sundays at 11:30, immediately following Face the Nation on WUSA TV9. We'll be back next Thursday at 11 with plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott. Next week on BGov's Capital Impact, the Pentagon is losing its fight against post-war budget reductions and has now begun revising its strategy to identify a force structure consistent with lower budgets. How will that happen? Dr. Kevin Brancato and Robert Levinson, both defense analysts with Bloomberg Government, will be here to explain on the next Capital Impact.